Hey everyone, welcome back to Building the Ballot. I am joined today by David Metter. So David, you may know as Cooperstown Dave on Twitter. And I'll tell you one thing that is a black hole in my Hall of Fame knowledge slash interest. I mean, I admit I'm not as interested in this side of the game, but in this side of the process, but David is definitely making me more interested is the non-player portions of the ballot. And as you may know that coming up this year, we do have a non-player ballot. So this is going to be something that's very timely. So welcome to the show, David.
Thanks, Adam. Thanks for having me. I love the podcast. I'm honored to be here.
Excellent. So, we've corresponded quite a bit on Twitter, but this is the first time we've talked over Zoom face-to-face here like this. So can you tell the listeners a little bit about your background on where the Cooperstown Dave account came from? I know you were had an account for Vlad and his candidacy before that, and maybe kind of what got you to baseball Twitter in the first place?
Sure. Yeah, I grew up as a baseball fan. You know, like many people, through my dad or something like that. And for better or worse, the Phillies were really bad. I'm from the Philly area. They're really bad in the 90s, which meant didn't get to see a lot of winning, but it meant cheaper seats probably. So we went a lot in like 96, 97, a lot of like Medre Cummings maybe or Desi Rutherford days. And for whatever reason, I went to a Harrisburg Senators game at some point, which was at the time the minor league affiliate of the Expos, where I saw Vlad Guerrero play for the first time. And I kind of fell in baseball love. And, you know, he was part of the rookie class with Scott Rolen and Andrew Jones. And being from Philly, everybody really was big on Rolen, as I was. But I hitched my wagon to Vlad, which was kind of an odd thing to do. But it was cool because I ended up kind of watching this whole career through box scores and whatnot at the time. And then to just fast forward, you know, he hit 318 for his career with 449 home runs, which was like Lou Gehrig, Jimmy Fox-like stuff. And then his first year on the baseball writer's ballot, he got around 71%. And I almost like took personal offense to this. It was like, how do these numbers not get in immediately? So even though I knew he was pretty likely to get in the next year, I started this Twitter account, Vlad4HOF, and having read about what some others had done for Burt Blylevin and Tim Raines, and I got what I guess was called the play index at the time on baseball.
Yep. That's what it was at the time, yes.
Yes, now Stathead more or less, and was able to pull together all these different stats. I did a bunch of research finding anecdotes and whatnot and cross-referenced that information with Ryan Thibodeau's Hall of Fame tracker information and very politely followed voters and emailed them once. You know, I don't like how people harass the voters sometimes, but I put together almost three different pieces of collateral, one that was traditional stat-minded, one that was more analytic and sort of a hybrid. And I dialogued with some people and he ended up getting over 90% his next year. I'm not saying I don't know if I moved the needle at all, but that was exciting. So I had this account that had some followers and that I was using to follow baseball Twitter people. And I just kept using it to dialogue with people like yourself. And I rebranded it, I guess, to Cooperstown Dave because the Vlad4HOF thing's a bit out of date. Mm-hmm. And here we are.
Yeah, excellent. I've really been enjoying the stuff that you've been working on. It's of course right in my wheelhouse, which I think puts it right in the wheelhouse of the people listening to this podcast. So when it was time to look ahead to a non-player's ballot, I know that this is something that you've been researching and we've been chatting a little bit about it through direct messages and whatnot. And it seemed like a perfect opportunity to get you on the show. So can you just kind of give a background on what the next ballot is that we're talking about here?
Sure. So as I'm sure most of your listeners know, there's sort of two paths to the Hall of Fame. There's the writer's ballot, which is just sort of recent players. Then there's the committee system, which has gone through a lot of evolutions, but there's three committees that rotate. The one that's coming this year is the non-players committee for 1980 to present. So That means it's individuals whose primary contributions come from being either a manager, umpire, or executive slash pioneer, and that the bulk of those people's work occurred after 1980. So it becomes a bit of a calculus in terms of deciding with people who've worked in the various categorical disciplines, which category are they most primary? Like, where did they do most of their work? And then where does it fall in a timeline with 1980 as the pivot point? But I mean, just additional a little bit, you know, it used to be called the Veterans Committee. That's what everyone knows. The Old Timers Committee, there was the Centennial Commission, which was kind of the early, somewhat similar thing that was more focused on 19th century. But like the other committees, it's 8 people will be on the ballot. You need to get 12 out of 16 votes. That's 75%. And again, there's a fuzziness with these categories at times. We all know what a player is. A manager, executive can be really fuzzy, and we'll talk more about that. But that's what this will be, and it will be voted on in December.
Right. Yeah, my entire history of doing this type of thing, I've been so focused on the players and their stats and how, you know, you can era adjust things and whatnot. So the non-players have always been kind of a black hole in that research of mine. So I'm excited to chat with you about filling that in a little bit. Like like what makes a Hall of Fame umpire, you know, that type of question.
Right. Yeah.
Maybe Cy Rigler is a great example of a candidate, you know, that type of thing. Somebody who's done a lot of World Series or has some famous moments, but you shouldn't be too famous as an umpire. So,
right. Yeah, it can be. I mean, Cy Rigler is an interesting case. I can't recall all my Cy Rigler knowledge offhand, but he is one of the one or two pre, let's say, 1950 umpires that him, Bob Emsley, and then someone I'm really high on, Bill Dineen. But those are the three that I think they were, I don't know if regular, but they might have all been on the honor rolls of baseball, which in 1946 was this sort of second tier for in the Hall of Fame, but separate from the plaques. But if you made the honor rolls, you were still eligible for the Hall of Fame, except writers were also part of the honor roll, and they ended up with the Spink Award separately, mostly. I didn't know how much interest I'd have in the non-players either. Of course, like most people, the players are the more interesting thing to me. But given what this ballot is, I decided to learn a bit more, and it was a lot more interesting than I expected. It's a bit odd diving deep into umpires, but I'm sure we'll touch on every category. But I ended up finding some sense of maybe what are the Hall of Fame benchmarks for some of these categories. Mm-hmm. But one of the things, like with Bill Dineen, who was really one of the most active, important umpires, yet is still omitted from the Hall for some reason, he had an excellent pitching career. I forget exactly, but over 40 WAR, he had a tremendous postseason moments. And that goes into this thing I'm really into, Rule B. Mm-hmm. So for the error committees, there's only three rules. There's rules A, B, and C. C is just, if you're on the ineligible list, you're not eligible. So pretty simple. A is just a combination of the rules for each category about players need to have played 10 seasons, retired for at least, I guess it's going to be 16 now, something like
right,
that.
Right, yeah.
And then managers and umpires need to have worked in 10 seasons at least, retired for 5 unless they're over a certain age, those sorts of things. But Rule B is this rule that I feel like people don't look to as much, yet not only does it exist, it's used, it seems pretty key. These three rules, there's not a ton of characters and words. It's not like Rule B is some obscure town ordinance dusted off from 1786 saying like you can't wear an orange shirt on Thursdays. It's there and it says, it relates to people who've worked in multiple categories, like player and umpire, or manager and executive. And it says that these people will be considered for their overall contribution. Will, it's not like can or could or should, but that somebody for the Hall of Fame, no matter what category is their primary category, they will be considered for their overall contribution. However, the specific category that they'll be considered for will be determined by the role in which they were most prominent. So that opens the door, and this is why I'm interested in it. It kind of opens the door for more Hall of Famers, which I think is something many of us enjoy when we look at players. And it can include players because of the cross-disciplinary nature. So it's really impactful. It also dictates where people fall in these committees, because the first thing you have to do, it's like an order of operations. What category was somebody most prominent in? A lot of times it's pretty obvious. Tony La Russa played in the majors. Maybe he had some league work too, I don't know, but he's a manager. But right. Then there are fuzzier ones like Felipe Alou. Mm-hmm. But either way, first you have to identify the category where they're most prominent. And then that where they did that work against this 1980 timeline is where they fall. So if Felipe Alou, we consider his playing career his most prominent, he'd be the pre-1980 group. And that has huge ramifications. Because the pre-1980 ballot in the current system, as you know, is all categories, like all leagues, it's a monster. And there's going to only be 8 people on that ballot. Mm-hmm. So I'm someone who really wants to see him get in. So I think his biggest contributions would be like manager or pioneer-like. So I'd want him at least on the post-1980 because there's obviously just less competition.
I feel like this post-1980 non-players ballot is the thinnest. Like I think I've said before on a previous podcast, if there's one change I could make to this process, the non-player ballot would be an all-time ballot. That is one change that I would make, but it's not. So I think that that's a really interesting consideration for something like someone like Felipe Alou, because yeah, like you said, like if he's up against, you know, La Russa and, you know, there's a few other guys, I'm sure, but, you know, it's much different than going again up against everybody from like 1840 to 1980.
Yeah. And my sense is really like the pre-1980 non-player potential candidates is also a really kind of thin list. When it comes down to it, again, like there can't be more than a couple of umpires. I think they've done a pretty good job at like getting outside of the Negro League. Individuals mm-hmm. in black baseball, most of the executives and the managers, I mean, I can understand why Gene Mock isn't in, and but there's just a couple of people. It does seem like they should have just done all of history, or at least I think, as you suggested, change it to 1970 or just bring it back somehow.
Yeah, I mean, that was one possibility, but I think the cleanest thing to do would just be a non-players ballot and then a players pre-1980 and a players post-1980. Yeah, I think like manager-wise, outside of the Negro Leagues, I mean, Danny Murtaugh and right. Who else? Like, that's probably the biggest name I can
think of. Ralph Houk, is that how you say his name?
Ralph Houk would be a one for sure. But then,
there really aren't many, because really, like, one of the things I found on managers, there's 22 managers in the Hall of Fame. They've all won at least 2 pennants. Now that's something that's going to have to evolve, given it's a little easier to win 2 pennants when you were in an 8-team league.
Right.
But so there aren't that many, for one thing, using just that measure, managers who won 2 pennants who are not in the Hall. Houk is one, might be the only one offhand. But another thing about Rule B. So like it's on the books. I also see tremendous precedent for it. I'm like a lawyer about this. I mean, Al Lopez was a manager whose managerial record's a little light. His playing career is significantly light. I mean, he was a 2-time All-Star. He has like 16.5 WAR, but the first line on his plaque, that's the other thing. The plaques tend to speak to this overall contribution. The first line on his plaque reads, renowned for shrewd leadership during 36-year big league career as catcher and manager. that he's inducted as a manager. So there's a lot of people. Billy Evans, who's in as an umpire, big on the top of his plaque, it says umpire and executive. And he did like everything, and he had an element of fame. He was the boy umpire because he started working at age 22. He was a GM. He was president of a minor league where he did really important work. He's credited as the first ump to run down the first baseline to follow a play, which the more I've read about umpires, the more I really appreciate the early umpires, because they didn't have big crews. And it sounds like the play and game was a bit rowdier. There was a certain passion that maybe when you're making good money now, it doesn't come out. And like people are just, you know, you get through a game, people get upset sometimes, but you had to really like assert yourself and have a certain authority. Billy Evans also wrote a weekly column while he was an umpire. So in like a national paper. So he had a lot, and he like turned around the Cleveland organization as GM and only quit when they forced him to sell a player who he thought would be really good named Pee Wee Reese. Mm-hmm. But there's a lot of people who have read Shane Dean's. Candy Cummings Hall of Fame candidacy is a bit unusual. I mean, he's kind of in for supposedly inventing the curveball, which we know not necessarily true. He was a very good player, but not like Hall of Fame level. Buck O'Neill's case is very Rule B like, where
right. The
idea of him as an executive is kind of not something you think of.
Yeah, that's another thing. Like, the Hall of Fame combines the executive / pioneer, but only lists the executive part on like the website or things like that. So you're looking at candidates that are so clear, like literally have never been executives. So, you know, you mentioned Cummings, like he was never an executive and he's listed as an executive in the Hall of Fame. You know, Chadwick, Cartwright, there's so many. Bud Fowler, even Frank Grant was a player. And
yeah,
he should be in as a player. And in fact, they've gone back and forth on the Hall of Fame's website with how they list him, because he was only a player, but he was a pioneering player. So they have him in as an executive, because executive includes pioneer. It's very bizarre.
And like, that's not to product manage this, but like, it's a feature, not a bug in a way. I think that just, I'm not trying to find a loophole here, but it's a thing that exists. I want to understand, I would like to maybe have to go to Cooperstown to check, but like, when did that Rule B get created? But even when I've read old newspapers stuff and books on the Hall of Fame from the earliest days, a lot of the language around it talked about, one word they used a lot was the builders of the game, which of course we've largely exhausted the quote builders, the earliest pioneers, but a lot of language tends to be about just like, well, it gets gendery, but like baseball men. It's about like baseball contributors. It's so not focused on players, even though the first class was only players, that I would like to see more of these baseball people. Like, that was some, one of the parts that made Buck O'Neill's election so exciting to me, is because not only is he meritorious for various obvious reasons, it's kind of just like honoring somebody who, it's not like there's that clear, he won two pennants as a manager or, you know, 300 wins as a pitcher or something.
Yeah, gosh, so many directions I can take this right now. Like, I think it opens up the door for, you know, anyone from some of the players, some of the candidates we've mentioned already, like Alou, to like even like a Tommy John. He is a player who has struggled to get in. And, you know, there are people who say, you know, well, he was a pioneer of, you know, the surgery. Is that enough? You know, is something like that enough to nudge him over? I happen to think he's a Hall of Fame player in his own right. But, you know, that's another question. Like, do you need to be like 80% of one and then at least 50% of another? It's like this weird, like filling up these bars, so to speak.
Yeah, I sometimes try to look at it that way. Like, I guess we'll probably talk about the managers, but like Lou Piniella is probably like, he fell one vote short last time on this committee ballot. And there's a very strong case to make that he's just worthy of the Hall of Fame on his managerial work. It's not the strongest, but really then when you add in like a very respectable, good playing career. Like, perhaps that should push him over the edge. If you're somebody only thinking about his managerial, like, manager work and think he's short, I want you to know, like, you're not supposed to ignore that playing career. I'm a certain age where I wasn't around for his playing career, so I don't know it firsthand. I think of him as the manager. I don't necessarily think of him on as Joe Torre or, you know, some of these guys who won more. But I just really think it's a great way to get more in. I think Marvin Miller was another case of like a different type of executive. The idea that they put the union leader in just creates more flexibility. John Montgomery Ward's plaque, or maybe it's not on the plaque, but on the page's website. He was, you know, an early pioneer regarding players' rights. So like that's another angle where when we talk about like Curt Flood or people outside of just you own a team, you're a GM, you're a league president, et cetera. So I love the idea of being more flexible with all this.
Curt Flood's a great one because he's going to bring up Pioneer into the conversation, which I'm not looking to have a separate Pioneer category. If anything, maybe the category should just be blended into contributions to baseball. Because that brings me to another thing. Like I can think of like probably at least five Hall of Famers that I would say fill that bar, like the 100% bar, in more than one category. Mm-hmm. And all of them are not in as players, even though they probably should be. I'm thinking Rube Foster probably fills it in three. Yeah. So he's player. Amazing. I think he's a Hall of Fame player, Hall of Fame manager, Hall of Fame executive. Throw Hall of Fame Pioneer in there too, if you want, you know, to separate executive and pioneer. Al Spalding, of course, was a great pitcher early on. Clark Griffith was a 60 WAR pitcher before his post-playing days. Joe Torre is an obvious one as well that people bring up these days. And I know I had one more player on that list. John McGraw was the last one, yeah, who I think had a short but incredibly high peak, probably Hall of Fame worthy career. It would have been if he didn't decide he wanted to manage instead.
Yeah, and if I recall correctly, at least, like, I wonder if his career as a player was a little undervalued. He was like the king of the walk in a way. Mm-hmm. Like,
right.
And, you know, I wonder how much that was valued then, even though it looks like he was pretty well regarded. But like, I think now his style of play would be more appreciated. I'm sure there are others that fill up the 100%. I mean, maybe Connie Mack as manager and executive, right, even though his playing career was, you know, I think he may have like 6 WAR as a catcher, though. And it's long ago with shorter seasons, but it's still short.
Yeah, it always kind of bugged me a little bit that, you know, Joe Torre is in as a manager, because I think the people that go to the Hall of Fame might not think of the great playing career that he had, or like Rube Foster, you know, having to be forced into one of those buckets as well, which I think he's technically in the executive bucket. Right.
But at the same time, and this is one of the things where I think it speaks to the importance of this, like the contributions across categories being important and valuable, is the hall itself, all the plaques are together, you know? So I don't think there's anything that marks them.
No.
So I think maybe they're in chronological order by election, but so they're all together. And again, like the individual person, people's plaques will reference a certain amount. Like I think Connie Mack being a player is referenced despite him not doing nearly as much in that category as others, but there's just all these different ways in rule, in precedent, that this seems to be the way we're meant to view the assessing Hall of Famers outside of the writer's ballot in this committee system. And so when people talk about Davey Johnson, it's like, let's also look just as important of a way even at the playing career, even if we're going to then just categorize, which is really just a filing system or something for which committee to put them on and where to place them on a website.
Yeah, and to be clear, like, you're right. That's how the plaques are arranged in the museum itself. I guess I was thinking more for the people that don't go to the museum, who are, you know, browsing Hall of Famers through the website or the, through categorizations on other websites, such as Baseball Reference or something. You know, they would see manager for Joe Torre and maybe not click through to those great seasons that he had. I guess, like, the question is, you know, what's more prestigious? Would it be if Torre was in as a player who also had other contributions, or if he was in as a manager only, or if he had this combination type, you know, maybe they say he's in as a hybrid role, you know, maybe calling it a hybrid role would imply that he was under 100% in each one. So I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, in a way I was going to say, but that's what I love about it is that, like, if everyone could just understand and be aware of rule B, then it doesn't matter. But on the other hand, this isn't what you're really suggesting, but what if, and I'm not really suggesting this, but, like, what if Joe Torre should still be on as a player? Like, what if it was an additional thing? Like, you're in the Hall of Fame for this and this, like, in those specific ways. I mean, but anyway, I know I'm prattling on.
Yeah. So, like, the honor is Hall of Famer in general.
Right.
And then you can have special badges on it. Was a Hall of Fame player, was a Hall of Fame manager, and some combination candidates might just be regular Hall of Famer without any of the specific badges.
Right.
And now I'm gamifying the Hall of Fame induction.
Well, yeah. Yeah, I know. That's exactly what I'm thinking of it. I'm trying to entertain all the possibilities, but I got so much information here. I don't know where, if you want to go to managers, you want to dive into.
Yeah, let's dive into managers. We got a bunch to cover here.
Yeah, I'll try to go quickly. So, like, you know, the first Hall of Fame class was five players. The next one, though, included a couple managers and executives. So the manager piece was present very early on. Then they were referenced in the honor rolls in 1946. But there are 22 managers in the Hall of Fame. The last to get in were Cox, Torre, and La Russa, all in 2014. And between those three, that takes up a lot of managerial Hall of Famerness for the post-1980 era, right? The rules, you have to have managed for at least 10 years and have been retired for at least five. If you're over 65 years old, you only have to, you're eligible after just 6 months after retirement. So, you know, this means, you know, people like Bruce Bochy and Dusty Baker and Terry Francona are, of course, not eligible because they're active. There are probably a few that are a little short in years. I mean, Don Baylor, I don't think anyone would say was a Hall of Fame manager, but his playing career is, I think he's a very underrated player, especially as, like, he was a really important union rep. But even if you liked him as a manager for some reason, he's 9 years, he's too short. Dick Houser's another one. Ozzie Guillen's also short on years. When it comes to some benchmarks for the Hall of Fame managers, from what I could tell, like, the average and median sort of game, like, being around for a long time and winning is, of course, big. Like, 3,500 games tends to be what the typical Hall of Fame manager has. A little under 2,000 wins. Winning at least two pennants, again, is, like, the floor. There are some managers in the Hall of Fame that won zero World Series, but they all won at least two pennants. And in terms of this era, again, Cox, Torre La Russa, Tommy Lasorda is in, Whitey Herzog, Sparky Anderson, if you want to say he's post-80, I guess you would. Dick Williams is probably before. But those are the names. Billy Martin would probably be pre-1980. He's not in, but so he's somebody you can kind of exclude. Chuck Tanner's probably someone you push to pre-1980. I just like to kind of clear the deck of, like, who do I not have to think about?
Right, that's the question of, like, who with all of these rules, like, right. Bruce Bochy just took himself off the list by being active again, and I don't think he fits the age requirement either.
Right.
My list is Davey Johnson, Lou Piniella, and I believe Mike Socia is finally eligible for the first time.
So Mike Socia, I think I emailed the Hall of Fame about it, and what they told me was, when it comes to eligibility stuff, that it's just determined. Like, because he's 64, he'll be 65 November 27th. The Hall of Fame committee is expected to meet the first week of December. So I think that that literally might be the cutoff. They weren't super clear for that. So he might be, he's done a lot of work in baseball, but he has a manager. He last managed in 2018. So between 2018, and 2023, he's right there with the 5 years. And for the age 65 thing, he's just like right there. So he might be eligible. The other names that I, you know, Tom Kelly's been on the ballot before. So I think that makes him a very possible candidate. Charlie Manuel has been on the ballot. Jim Leland, I don't think has, and has a pretty good case. Another person who should be eligible because of age might be Joe Maddon. And Cito Gaston is certainly eligible. And, you know, he won two World Series, the first African-American to win a World Series as a manager. I feel like he doesn't really get talked about enough. Those are probably, and then you got other cases that are a bit more challenging. Mike Hargrove didn't win a World Series, won a couple pennants, but he might be a player candidate, really. It's a tough call there. But, you know, excellent player. He had 30 WAR. He won Rookie of the Year. And but
I always have to remind myself, was it Hargrove or Burrows that won Rookie of the Year and the other one won MVP? I have to like always cycle through that in my head. But anyway.
Yeah. And yeah, Felipe Alou is like really complicated because in a way, like, he's even a complicated player case because he's one of these cases where his values kind of spread across. He's not like the great slugger or the great batting average guy or the stolen base guy. He's one of these players who he's probably, you know, he's short as a player for the Hall of Fame, but just the nature of how his value carried out. He had 42.4 wins above replacement. But, you know, he was also like the first regular in Major League Baseball, like from the DR, from Dominican Republic. He was the first Dominican manager. He was the first or the second non-interim Latin-born manager, other than Preston Gomez, who managed some bad teams, not faulting him. But Felipe Alou is really the first prominent Latin-born manager. Mm-hmm. And he seems to have done a lot of things to help further the causes for Latin-born players. He's a huge figure in Dominican baseball. And you look at the league as it is now, I mean, for half of a small island, it's incredible. I mean, baseball is everything. And Felipe Alou just like reeks Hall of Famer to me, even though, you know, just on the numbers as manager, he's short. He didn't, you know, win a, I don't know if he even won a pennant.
Did he? Well, he would have in 94 probably.
Right. But... and, you know, he, you know, was key in helping Vlad Guerrero in his early years. He's somebody, Peter Karasotis, who wrote a biography on Felipe Alou. I was talking to him and he made a really good point that I hadn't thought of, which is we see that in the Hall of Fame, we kind of go back and reasonably, as far as I'm concerned, we understand that certain players were given short shrift, to say the least, by not being able to play in the quote white major leagues because of racial prejudice. Felipe Alou, if not probably for slowness to further integrate into other levels, probably would have been a manager earlier in his life. He didn't manage until he was 58 on a non-interim basis. If he had got a chance to manage earlier, perhaps he would have like a Tony La Russa level amount of games and wins and opportunities to win in the postseason. And maybe that's something that should be considered too, that sort of injustice and impact of prejudice in other levels, not just players. So another thing I'm passionate about is like, let's get people in while they're alive.
Right.
And I think Felipe's 88 or something like that. So I just don't know what category we put him in.
That is a really interesting point about, you know, his delayed start And, you know, I'm just sitting here thinking, is he the Manny Minoso of managers, so to speak? And then not only does that make him a great player and manager candidate, but, you know, that his bar for pioneer is certainly not going to be empty. So, you know, maybe he's an 80% player, maybe he's an 80% manager, but that's because of, you know, the pioneering nature of his career as well. And you can see how these things add up and lead to, you know, it's not your straightforward candidacies. You're looking into spider charts and whatnot and figuring things out, you know, and that goes against what people say. Oh, if I have to think about it, it's not a Hall of Famer. Well, fine. Don't think about it. Go away and, you know, not think about other things. Like, we want to be smart about this. We want to think about people like Felipe Alou.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, he has like a little over 1,000 wins. The average Hall of Fame manager has like 1,900. He won. I got the wrong person here. Yeah, he didn't win a pennant. I hope we can find a way to get him in. Other people, there's a lot of people with, you know, wonderful careers. Jack McKeon. You know, I think that you're right on, I think ultimately, because I have a lot of information that I could go through, but Pinella, Davey Johnson, Davey Johnson certainly has a Rule B case given his playing career. Mm-hmm. And he's also been on 4-5 ballots, or Davey, they, it seems like the committees like Davey Johnson.
So they're like putting him on. Yes.
Right. He's always gotten the like under 5 or under 3 votes, but, Pinella, Davey Johnson, Jim Leland, maybe Joe Madden, maybe Mike Socia, Tom Kelly, Gaston. I was heartened as a Phillies fan to see Charlie Manuel make the ballot that one time, but, you know, I think it's probably a little short.
Yeah, that was definitely like, that seemed like we just changed the rules. There aren't really that many players. Well, I guess then it was players and non-players on the same ballot. There aren't that many candidates put Manuel on, but yeah, I don't see a case there. Unless somebody wants to make it, I'm happy to listen, but
winning consecutive pennants was pretty cool. I mean, and he's just a very likable guy. I'm sure that doesn't hurt. And to shift, if you want, cause I know I'm not going to take all your time here on umpires, talk about where I think likable is important. The umpires as part of the Hall of Fame, the first to get in was in 1953, and it was Tommy Connolly and Bill Clem, who would be the first two you put in the Hall of Fame at that point in history. They kind of represented, as I understand it, sort of the two different archetypes of an umpire. Tommy Connolly was the really stoic, you know, he would get into it because he had to, but the sort of the stiff upper lip type umpire, while Bill Clem was a little more in your face. I was able to find the first reference to maybe putting umpires in the Hall of Fame in a Sporting News article in 1937, where this writer was kind of humorously suggesting some things that should get into the Hall of Fame, like the turnstile should be elected, or the alibi, like making excuses. But then there's a little paragraph that's very kind of serious about umpires. Like, what is baseball without umpires? Nothing. It can't be played. You can play without a shortstop or an outfielder, but you can't play without an umpire. You end up with, you know, 11 of them were in that honor rolls in 1946, but Connolly and Clem get in at 53. There are 10 umpires in the Hall of Fame across all these years, 0 from the Negro Leagues, which is something I would like to learn more about. But
right. The
last one and the only one that would in any way be a part of this era was, oh my gosh, I'm blanking.
Joe West?
No, I'm thinking of who's already in, Doug Harvey.
Oh, okay. I thought you meant this current era committee.
But yeah, for the current era committee, I mean, to just look at like, what are the types of things that seem important? Yeah, working a lot of games, working a lot of World Series. It's harder to work as many World Series as it used to be. I think Clem worked 18. That's a lot. It seems like they tend to rotate them now. On the other side of it, though, you can work more games in your career, like regular season games, because schedules change. You got big umpiring crews that definitely didn't exist. In terms of people from this era previously on the ballot. There aren't any. But Steve Palermo and John McSherry were considered. They're interesting cases, and it shows that a certain heart to the process. They both endured some like tragic circumstances that because really like they didn't have the longest careers necessarily, but John McSherry famously, he passed away on the field in 1996. And Palermo, his career ended in like heroic. I mean, him and someone else were out to dinner and they tried to stop a mugging and he got shot and paralyzed. He ended up doing a lot of important work in the league office. But by the typical measures for the umpires in the Hall of Fame, they typically don't stack up, but they absolutely had great careers. McSherry did work a couple World Series and many LCS, but in terms of like likely candidates, Joe West is obviously the big name. He broke Bill Clem's games record. He has a somewhat checkered reputation, which I wonder, you have to wonder how whoever it is that runs the sort of committee to put together the ballot, how quick they will be. Most of these umpires weren't elected while alive. It's not like a process where they're as quick to get them in. But whether he gets in this year or not, or makes this ballot or not, he will end up in. He was in the league forever. He became head of their union. He did get into a number of little battles, whether with Joe Torre or a variety of other players and managers. But him, Jerry Davis, and Bruce Fremming are kind of the three that I think are really above the rest and likely to have a shot. Jerry Davis is fourth all time in games. He did six World Series, which is a big number for the past few decades. Bruce Fremming is third all time in games. He worked five World Series. These are people who were umpires for several decades. Mm-hmm. And to have managed that is no small feat. And Bruce Fremming and Jerry Davis, I mean, they've all done a lot of different things. Jerry Davis is credited. He pioneered a certain stance that a lot of umpires use. They call the Jerry Davis system, about like keeping your head locked in a certain consistent position. So although there's a number of other umpires that will qualify, those are the three that really kind of stand out.
Nice. I wonder if, after this generation of umpiring candidates, if we'll actually get into evaluating umpires based on modern metrics that can maybe tell us how good they were, because we actually don't know that about any of these prior candidates. But now we have pitch locations and, whether they were right about the calls, and, we can see how many times their calls were overturned and all that. So it's kind of brings a little bit of a statistical element to seeing who the best umpires are. Although I have to say, I haven't seen a ton of studies around that. I don't know how much of how much people are clamoring for that. I do love that Twitter account that shows the umpire scorecards, though.
That's cool. There was that umpire whose name escapes me who had like a quote perfect game in the playoffs or something like that. And it's interesting, like reading up on some of these umpires, there have been numerous like player polls throughout the years. And let's say it was for Sports Illustrated in a given year, and there's a top five best and top five worst umpires. Sometimes the same umpire makes both lists.
Right.
So that shows you how volatile the situation is in terms of like who is at least perceived as good or liked.
These are the most popular ones, and this is whether I like them or not.
And maybe that comes down to like the hitters like them and the pitchers don't, or the other way around.
That's a really interesting one. Yeah.
But because Jerry Davis was famous for having a very small strike zone. So imagine hitters probably like that quite a bit. And Jerry Davis, these are people who worked for a long time. Joe West had some issues with suspensions and whatnot. Jerry Davis and Bruce Remming, less so. But again, when you're, it's a tough job. I really think people don't give the umpires enough credit. No one wants to say that. That's not fun. But at the same time, whatever might have given someone a headache about a Joe West, I think you then look back and you're like, it's great to have a character. You know, right. They shouldn't be the focus of the game, but let's be real. It's not like he was, you know, in the scope of history and everything. It's not really the case. He also famously was in the Naked Gun and had a line. He was an AL umpire and he said something to Enrico Palazzo, the umpire that Leslie Nielsen played, which I didn't realize and something I learned, which I now love. He says something about, you can't throw out an umpire or something. So he also like a country singer. He's a big entertainer.
Oh, yeah. And a Wikipedia editor, apparently.
Yes, I saw that recently. And I wondered, yeah, so for your listeners, it's like he went in and seems like there's pretty good evidence to suggest he may have been editing his own Wikipedia page. As you can imagine, to his favor. I think I wonder if that's something that would be on the radar of the Hall of Fame. I don't know. Is that like an obscure, irrelevant thing? Because of all the categories, in a way, I think that there's an expectation of a certain level of respectability. Is that the word? Or
impartiality or something?
Yeah,
like that.
And like stay out of the way when it comes to umpires. But again, and then I think when you step back, it's almost just like, it's kind of fun. I mean, that's so silly. What's he doing? He's in retirement. He's one of the most famous umpires ever, and he's in there editing his Wikipedia page.
So for this ballot, probably the three candidates that you mentioned there, West, Fremming, and Davis, was it?
Yep. Yep. And then, I mean, executives is way fuzzier because at least we all know what a manager, umpire, and a player is. An executive could be an owner, a league president, commissioner. And then there's the whole pioneer fuzziness bucket. But when it comes to like the rules, you know, you have to be over 70 or retired for at least 5 years. And what counts as retired is a little I'm unclear on, and that's going to impact maybe Brian Sabian, who might be the best executive that could be on this ballot. But a lot of different things, you know, being a pioneer again, like founding something or creating a major change, innovating. Like Bill Veeck didn't necessarily have the most successful career as a GM when it comes to winning ball clubs. And it's really interesting when you look at his plaque. I mean, the random things that could be a part, because I think about the plaques because there's such a finite amount of characters that they're in, putting together someone's entire career on there. And yet, like Walter O'Malley's plaque mentions maintaining affordable ticket prices. Barney Dreyfus's mentions oversaw construction of early double-deck stadium. Bill Veeck's mentions exploding scoreboard and outrageous door prices. Larry McPhail's mentions pioneered nightball and originated plane travel by playing personnel and the idea of the stadium club. And so I think that suggests how much flexibility we can have when it comes to some of this stuff. I mean, I don't think originating plane travel for your players should be the bulk of your contribution, but these are fun little pieces of a career. And the fact that they find space, I mean, you work in product to find screen space in a user interface, you know, that's precious real estate. Imagine for a Hall of Fame plaque, they're talking about exploding scoreboards.
The Hall of Fame plaque is like a great parallel to mobile design. It's like exactly shaped the same way. Yeah.
And so for the 1980 and after era, the people who are already in, Bud Selig, John Scherholz, Pat Gillick, Bowie Kuhn, but not a lot. But at the same time, given what that work is, that's probably to be expected. There are quite a number of people who probably fit pre-1980. I won't go down that list. In terms of those people who are closer, like overlap into 1980, who've had a lot of ballot exposure, Ewing Kaufman, who was the founding owner of the Royals, has made a couple of ballots. I'm not entirely sure on like what the major interest is in Ewing Kaufman. He owned them from inception till death in 1993. And you know, they had their run in the 70s and 80s. But there must be something that the Hall of Fame likes about Ewing Kaufman. And the not yet eligibles list is pretty stacked, especially Brian Sabian's on that, which is unclear because he just took a job as an advisor with the Yankees. If not for that, just a few weeks ago, he would definitely be eligible. I've heard people suggest he still is. I wish I could get an answer on that. But, you know, Theo Epstein's an eventual Hall of Famer. That's pretty clear, but he's not eligible yet. Dave Dombrowski, to me, it seems like he's kind of put himself there. And by certain measures, Billy Beane seems like he would have a good chance, even though his team's never won one. Brian Cashman. And then there's some others. But in terms of previously on ballot, as well as, you know, setting aside Ewing Kaufman, because he's pre-1980, I think, there's George Steinbrenner, Bill White. And then, I mean, George W. Bush has made preliminary lists, you know, yeah. Which good for President Bush. Just because we're talking about Rule B and stuff, I think he'd certainly be a player, but I like to give Al Rosen just a little bit of due here in the sense of a very successful GM career. And I think a lot of us know he was an incredible third baseman. But he won like Executive of the Year award in 1989, and he helped turn a last place Giants team into a pennant winner in 4 years. Really incredible career, and he won a World Series with the Yankees as the president and CEO. Otherwise, I mean, the likely candidates, Brian Sabian, I mean, they won three World Series with the Giants as GM. They won four pennants. He was a scout and worked in a role with the Yankees that really helped build a lot of those 90s teams that won. In my view, after really looking all this over, he's like a definite eventual Hall of Famer. How quickly it comes, I don't know. George Steinbrenner, I don't know. I'm curious what you think of this. Like, he certainly had his run-ins with the league. But I feel like if today you went out on the street and asked people, name an owner of a baseball team, they'd still right. say George Steinbrenner before anybody else, and he hasn't been alive for 12 years.
Right.
And, like, isn't there something to that? Like, if we're putting in owners, and there was a lot of winning there. I mean, I know it's not exciting to elect owners, but I wonder what you make of that.
The thing with Steinbrenner is, yeah, it would make sense for him to be a Hall of Famer, but, you know, all signs point to like garbage human, treated people like crap. You know, I can't get excited about him. And luckily, that's all I have to do. If I was on one of these committees, it would be a much more difficult conversation because I would have to compare him to other candidates. And, you know, it would be tough because just don't like the guy. So I guess that's kind of where I come down.
Yeah, I mean, so here's the only reason I would counter on not his character, but like one thing I kind of largely, but not always, want to set aside the character thing with these matters of the Hall of Fame. But if nothing else, it's like, if that's the case, then I just don't want him on the ballot. Like, I worry about, like, these are precious spots to be on the ballot. So in my mind, if like there is any momentum, he's never really performed well on the ballots. He's always gotten so few votes that they don't tell you how many votes he got. But at that point, so to me, it's more just like either get him in or get him off the ballot. I tend to have that attitude. So I have no skin in the game. I'm not passionate about George Steinbrenner beyond the Seinfeld character, maybe. Mm-hmm. But so him, Walt Jocketty is another possible candidate. He won four Sporting News Executive of the Year awards, which is kind of the main executive award. And the only other people to win, wait, sorry. He's one of four to win it three times. And the others are Branch Rickey, who's in the Hall, George Weiss, who's in, Billy Beane, who's not yet eligible. That's it. he worked with several clubs. He brought in Tony La Russa. With Oakland, he helped build those teams in the late 80s, early 90s that were very successful. Then he helped do it with the Cardinals. He was with the Reds for a very long time, which I think at this point most people think of him of. But he helped found the Arizona Rookie League and the Dominican Summer League. He's been a major figure. He seems like, after Sabian, among possible sort of typical GM types, he'd be the next guy. Bill White is somebody who I think a lot of us are increasingly, or some of us I talk to at least, interested in. Excellent player. He was NL president. He helped oversee the expansion with the Marlins and the Rockies joining baseball. He still is the highest ranking person of color in any of the major leagues. I mean, at least certainly when he got that role. And he has said things subsequently that he feels he was maybe a figurehead and didn't get as much opportunity. But really, when you look at commissioners and league presidents, there aren't league presidents anymore, but anybody who worked in those roles longer than him are more or less in the hall. So to think about just that, plus the fact that he was a heck of a player, seems like a Hall of Famer.
I love his playing career and wonder if it was so good that he is on the other ballot, which would make it a much more difficult climb for him. White would be, he's like Alou. I would love to put them on this ballot to get a really good look at them on a, you know, maybe a less crowded field. But I'm not sure if he can really make that case. They were both really great players.
Yeah, and he was the first African-American broadcaster for a major league team. Steinbrenner tried to hire him as GM twice. He didn't really want it. As many probably recall, working for George Steinbrenner was sometimes a short-lived thing. He didn't perform that well on the baseball writer's ballot. He was on three times and polled under 2%. So that must have been before the 5% rule. He's made a few ballots in when there were sort of composite committee ballots, which was like all roles. It's a good point about what role does he fit? Does he fit as a player? But the totality of it seems like perhaps a worthy person. A name that I'm really high on after doing a lot of reading on this that I don't hear as much about is Roland Heeman. Roland Heeman. For one thing, you want to talk about, as you shared about George Steinbrenner, everything you hear and read about him is the total opposite.
Right.
And he worked in baseball forever in every possible role, from selling tickets. He would sweep the floors to becoming GM. He was executive of the year twice, and those two times were 17 years apart. He was in baseball for 70 years. He was central in forming the Arizona Fall League. He wrote up Hank Aaron's first contract as assistant scouting director with the Braves. He was the first ever scouting director with the Angels. He then became GM of the White Sox when Bill Veeck was there. He gave Tony La Russa his first manager job ever. He did so many things, and he was a key mentor to so many that came after him: Dave Dombrowski, Walt Jocketty. He gave Dave Dombrowski his first like entry points into baseball. There's a Sabre Award named after him, like for the work he did with scouts. This is somebody who I really want to see get in. He won the Buck O'Neill Lifetime Achievement Award by the Hall of Fame, which is honoring like positive impact.
Wasn't he the first to win it after? I think Buck technically was the first, or
right.
Maybe I'm wrong there. I think it was Heeman then next.
Maybe, but yeah. And unfortunately he's no longer with us. So that then counters with my general interest of like, get the living people in. But really, I was watching videos and stuff around when he passed away, And there's such reverence with how people spoke about him. So he's somebody that I really would hope would. Otherwise, then I think he gets to somewhat of a different tier. Andy McPhail, who, you know, maybe for one thing, he's a McPhail, which gives you a really high chance at the Hall of Fame, given he's got his father and grandfather in. But he was GM of the Twins teams that won World Series. Donald Fair, I mean, probably not a lot of energy for him, but he was Marvin Miller's protege with the MLBPA. And he really seemed to do his best in helping battle the collusion of the 1980s, which is a piece of history that I think is lost and not discussed enough about, and how much that could have really ruined baseball to an extent. And, you know, Sandy Alderson, I've got a variety of other names, Larry Lucchino, John Hart. But I think, you know, owners, I don't know if Ted Turner is worth a look if for the people who are into the owners. Dan Duquette, who unfortunately just didn't win enough, but certainly, you know, he put together those that great Expos team that could have maybe won in 94 and signed Vlad out of the DR. And then there's a sort of just like the outside the box group. Like, I like the idea of Don Zimmer as a Hall of Famer. This is another person kind of like Heeman who was in baseball forever. He did manage for 14 years, which was lost on me somehow. But, you know, famously the coach for the Yankees for people more my age. But he when I was reading up on him, he played Cuban winter ball in 52-53. It was on the same team as Ray Dandridge, Silvio Garcia, Manny Mignoso. And so he played all over the world.
I was in Puerto Rico too. Yeah, I was talking to Jorge Colon Delgado, and he was showing up on these teams that had these stacked outfields with like Negro League players and whatnot. And there's Don Zimmer there as the shortstop.
And unfortunately, he's in part the reason why baseball started mandating batting helmets, because he got hit in the head and needed multiple operations. And it wasn't until after that they mandated helmets. So. But he even played in Japan. He played everywhere. The other, just to quickly go through them, like, as you said, Tommy John, the doctor who created it, Dr. Frank Job, the surgery was pre-1980, but my gosh, if he's extended, his work extended so many careers, if that's not like a contribution to baseball, I don't know. Seems like it is to me. He also pioneered a shoulder surgery, which was first done on Oral Hershiser, which maybe doesn't have the snappy name because Oral Hershiser surgery isn't exactly Tommy John. But Bill James, I think, is somebody who, you know, for one thing, he did work with the Red Sox and work that arguably helped them win. And of course, just, you know, in perhaps a Chadwick-like way, would be. John Thorne, maybe Scott Boris. I've got, you know, people talk about your boss, Sean Foreman, over at Sports Reference, which is really, you know, he's too young to be eligible, but, you know, another person who just like off the radar that I think about, if you think it out later, if certain innovations and pioneering is worth the Hall of Fame, maybe I think the person who started StatCast, that company is, you know, kind of changing a lot of how the game is played and the information we're getting. And then I'm big on the idea of the pitching coaches to get some representation, especially if they've got a Rule B bent, like Mel Stottlemyre had a great career. But even regardless of that, like pitching coaches, Dave Duncan, I selfishly would like the Philly Fanatic to get a plaque. I think the San Diego Chicken maybe has priority, but, you know, Manny Mota, somebody who I was just reading about the other day, these types of baseball figures who are in forever, you know, I'm not going to put them on my ballot necessarily, but I think it gets overlooked, these people in these certain other roles, especially coaches.
Yeah. Sean McKillop on Twitter sent me this enormous list. He's like, sorry that you're talking about pioneers and non-players. And he sent me a list from beginning of time to today. And a lot of the names that you mentioned, like even going back to like Doc Adams, Will Wheaton, William Tucker, Lewis Wadsworth, then for like ballparks, Janet Murray Smith, Roy Hofhines, Zachary Taylor, Dave, like, and Hall of Fame creation, we've got Stephen Clark, Alexander Cleland, players.
John Hadler, is he on there?
Oh, I don't know if he's on here.
Because he's like an interesting one to me when it comes to, he was NL president for, I guess, just a minute, but he was one of the early people with the Hall of Fame. He's an earlier person that, I guess I'm blanking on the contributions, but there are a number of people, but like, you know, how many people do we need to go back? Oh, John Hadler then had the second. Yeah. Okay. He then got the NL president job again and was president for like 17 years, which I don't think there's anybody who was like a league president or a commissioner anywhere near 17 years who's not in the Hall of Fame. So his omissions always sort of confused me.
Yeah, on the site that I have with Graham Womack, he was on a ballot in 76 and then was on the preliminary phase as recently as 2007. So he's kind of been on the radar over many, many decades.
And yeah, and then like commissioners, they're basically all in except General Eckert, who was commissioner for just a few years and probably was sort of a figurehead. Peter Uberoff, who, not a fan. He kind of came in and told the owners, like, what are you doing? Why aren't you just trying to make the most money as you can? You're a fool for trying to just win it for this, at the expense of money. And then there's just, you know, Bart Giamatti, sadly, was commissioner for a very short time.
Right.
Faye Vincent, who was kind of like the last somewhat players type commissioner before, because he didn't necessarily toe the line of the owners. They were like, let's get Bud in. And then that's literally all the commissioners. Everyone else is in or is Rob Manfred.
Right. So we got a lot of names here, Dave. Do we want to try to, I'm a little intimidated still by putting together an 8-person ballot, but I'm wondering if you have an 8-person ballot in mind from post 1980 candidates, that is.
I do. So, you know, who I want and who I think is likely. I think either way, Lou Piniella, I'm going to just go with what I think will happen in a way. Okay. Lou Piniella, he got 11 out of the necessary 12 votes last time. Before that, he was on the ballot and he got a little less. I don't know if anybody has gotten, well, Dick Allen's fallen short by one vote twice.
Twice. Doc
Adams,
row, yeah.
Doc Adams, I think, fell short by two and then didn't make the ballot.
Yeah.
But Lou Piniella, at least just looking at the history, it's like, you got to, I kind of think Steinbrenner makes the ballot. Brian Sabian, if he's eligible, absolutely should be. It's frustrating. I can't confirm that. I would say Bill White. So that puts me at four. The umpire thing is just so tricky. I have to put at least one of them on. It's kind of just throwing a dart out there, but I guess let's just say Joe West. Bruce Fremming is the oldest of the three. So on that measure, I kind of prefer him, but we'll go Joe West. That's five. It's hard to know what they'll do. I think Jim Leland probably has a good shot. I guess Davey Johnson, because he always gets on. Not that he's not worthy. And then I really hope it's Roland Heeman. But I've also, you know, Felipe Alou, it's tough. These are all, I forget how many I got down there, but I might have snuck in nine.
I got eight with Johnson and Heeman at the end there. I'm assuming that if Mike Socia is eligible, that he'd be on, or maybe they don't put him on that quickly. Or maybe they use that as an excuse to say he wasn't quite eligible. I don't know. We'll see.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's tough with the age and the number of years retired for some of these things, because John Morosi, I think it was, wrote an article recently suggesting that Sabian's going to be eligible. And I wish I knew for sure, because if not for this new Yankees job, he would be. And he seems just like an absolute clear Hall of Famer. Socia, yeah. Socia is 20th in wins amongst managers. He obviously had a very good playing career, perhaps an underrated playing career. The thing is, with both Pinella and Socia, but Pinella maybe most acutely since he's so close, Pinella only won the one pennant. He did win the World Series that year. So I talk about, as you've probably noticed, Adam, about the innings floor for pitchers, and that there's going to be a pitcher who kind of sets a new floor in Billy Wagner, that I tend to hesitate with something like that. But again, it's a bigger league now with many more teams. I also think when it comes to managers, for example, I guess it was Al Dark won a World Series his first year with Oakland, but he inherited a World Series winner. I think context matters. Bill James wrote an article trying to put together information on what's a Hall of Fame manager and trying to incorporate the idea of outperforming expectations. Mm-hmm. And in that sense, when you think about what Lou Piniella did, I was a toddler, but my sense would be he took over a team that had just been racked by the Pete Rose scandal when their player manager was under investigation. It's not just any player manager. It was the hit king. They won 70 some games. The very next year, Lou Piniella comes in. That wasn't the most talented roster. And they beat a behemoth in a way of an Oakland team. So it's hard to know exactly how much credit to give a manager, but in a way, like, that's a pretty big one, even though he only the one pennant. But Piniella is 17th on the wins list. So I don't know. These are things I think about.
That's an interesting team that you mentioned that too. Like fourth and fifth on their war leaders that year were relief pitchers.
Wow.
the nasty boys there, of course. But yeah, it was Jose Rijo was first. They had a Hall of Famer in Barry Larkin second. Chris Sabo third. That's a wonderful name to hear.
Yeah. My current favorite Jose Rijo fact is that he is the grandfather of Pablo Guerrero, Vladimir Guerrero Sr.'s son, who just recently signed with the Texas Rangers. This post, dad is Vlad Sr., his grandfather is Jose Rijo.
That's awesome. My all-time favorite Rijo fact will always be that he's the last player to be active after receiving a Hall of Fame vote.
Wow. Yeah. I have to process what you just said there.
He was hurt for like 6 years, and in the process, he had received a Hall of Fame vote.
Wow. Yeah, because I guess I wonder who else even did that. Minoso, maybe?
Yeah, I think Minoso is really. And then before those two, it was like they would give votes to active players all the time. But
right. So yeah, Socia. Yeah, I think he will. And he seems to be. Like, he does stuff, I think, with, like, Team USA, and he does a lot of stuff for the league. He's very active in baseball. I think these people who tend to be involved in baseball forever, that helps your chance, even if it's sort of stuff that's not as in our face as managing a major league club. And really, you look at, like, the list of managers by wins. If you're in the top 20, unless you're Gene Mauch, or you're an active manager, you're in, because it's Baker, Bochy, Mauch, Francona. Then at 17, it's Piniella, Leland, Showalter, Socia.
And a friend of the show, Mark Shirk, has been doing some research around catcher pitch framing. Sean Smith, who did the original Wins Above Replacement that then became Baseball References version, has done a more recent study on historical catcher framing. And Socia, if you are to believe these numbers, adds more than 20 WAR to his career total with his framing, which seems absolutely wild. But I don't know what to do with that stuff yet, because, well, you got to take it from somewhere. So I don't know. Are you taking it from Fernando and Oral? Are we trying to say that they weren't as good because Socia was a great framer? So I don't know what to think of any of that yet. That's why pitch framing at all is not in Baseball References WAR at all. Just how do you even deal with it?
And there's a lot of people around St. Louis who wish that change were to happen. But yeah, I'm a little skeptical. I'm unsure what to do with it. I know there's value there, but like you said, it has to come from somewhere. And then I'm curious about what you just said with the historical framing, because I know you're a Charlie Bennett fan, or at least did some work around him with the One Saber Committee, but I wonder what it says about him. Everything I've been going into newspapers.com, reading a lot about him, and just looking at certain numbers, it seems like he helped his pitchers do better. I don't have numbers offhand, but and obviously we're talking a long time ago, but I'd be curious to see what that may do with him.
Yeah, I've noticed you've been tweeting about Bennett, and I've been thinking, ooh, I'm slipping because there's a new Charlie Bennett stan in town who's doing more for him than I am. So I commend you on that. He's one of my guys. I like him a lot. Basically like a, you know, Pudge Rodriguez behind the plate and a Mickey Tettleton at the plate. So he's just a absolutely a unique player in that respect. I mean, unique in the respect that back then he wasn't hitting for average. He was walking and hitting for power as a catcher. And you've pointed this out. Sorry, this is not a player's podcast, but he caught all the time. And nobody did that back then.
No. And I mean, I'll be tweeting more in the coming days. I've got the thing loaded with scheduled tweets, but like they had these gloves that were, you know, a lot. There's people you'll see who the gloves they wear just because of the cold are much more protective. And they would use both hands. The idea that in a way he had the wherewithal to draw walks, because how the heck did you hit, like grip the bat and hit, when you were getting hit basically in the bare hand by pitches? I don't know how fast they were throwing, but let's just be really, let's say they were throwing 60 miles an hour. I mean, that takes a tremendous toll. He and his wife are credited with some of the earliest chest protectors. Mm-hmm. So you also were getting hit in the chest. There's so many stories of like huge gashes and things coming up on his hands. And he just stuck out there and, you know, Buck Ewing caught less than half of his games. Let me rephrase that. Half of the games Buck Ewing played were at catcher. He was a better hitter, but that's probably a bit related because it preserves your hands. Mm-hmm. But for Charlie Bennett to have something like a 119 OPS plus while catching as much as he did is awesome. And it seems like maybe that catcher defense outside of later with Ray Schalk wasn't that valued in the Hall of Fame world. So I'm very high on him, especially the more I hear the Yadier Molina talk, because if he's Yadier Molina, but from a different era and with more offensive value for, you know, relatively speaking.
You know, and maybe he is tangentially related because he could be an equipment pioneer. So there you go. That's why we talked about Charlie Bennett today.
There you go. Shoehorned it.
All right, David, I have taken a good amount of your time tonight, but I really want to thank you for this discussion on Rule B and all the non-player categories, the current state of affairs, the current candidates coming up. This was super helpful because, like I said, this is not my area of expertise, but got a lot to think about here. So I thank you for that.
You're welcome. And, you know, at the end of the day, as we've seen between Doc Adams falling two votes short and then not getting on, it's so hard to predict who makes these ballots and then how the vote goes. Sometimes it's just personal relationships dictating of how this all works out, but there's certainly some metrics that suggest what leads to a Hall of Famer. So I'm sure I didn't nail the ballot at the end, but I think it'll be something like that.
Yeah. And then, you know, this is again, just the 1980 to present. We didn't even touch on, you know, well, we just touched on early baseball there with Charlie Bennett, but like the Negro Leagues, there's no umpires, like you said earlier, very few managers, and we've got a lot of Rule B cases from the Negro Leagues that could be great, like Candy Jim Taylor or Vic Harris. I think those two are slam dunks. Dave Malarcher, there's a bunch of managers that could go in from the Negro Leagues.
I'll be looking forward to hearing you talk about that ballot, because squeezing everyone into eight people on that will be tough, but without getting further into that, I mean, Vic Harris, I hope he makes that, but you could easily put together several of those ballots of just Negro Leagues individuals. I don't envy the people putting together that ballot.
Yeah, that's why I wish this ballot went all time, so that Vic Harris, maybe he's up against Joe West and Brian Sabian again, instead of against, you know, every player from like 1860s to 1980.
Right.
What are you working on now that you can tell people about?
I'll be appearing, you know. I used to do comedy, so that makes me think I'm like doing my plugs. I've got a lot of Charlie Bennett content, which the masses are clamoring for. I have a lot of that loaded up, and I just, you know, shout out to Baseball Reference and Stathead, and I'm playing around on that. And, you know, I'll just keep trying to look at this ballot, and I'm trying to always learn more about the Negro Leagues, early Black baseball. You know, it's something that I grew up, again, around Philly. My dad was born in the 40s, a boomer, really into baseball. I used to go to baseball card shows and stuff all the time growing up, read a lot about baseball. It's amazing how little came past my way about the Negro Leagues, besides the names of like Josh Gibson and Satchel Paige. And that I've mentioned to my stepdad, who lifelong Philadelphian, about certain intersections in Philly. I'm like, did you know there used to be a ballpark there? And there was a major league team drawing a lot of people, well, you know, now considered major league team. It's not even on the radar. That's how segregated even the information was. So I'm learning more about that. And that's what I'm up to.
Awesome. Well, once again, thank you so much for joining. I'm glad we were able to get this going. We've been talking about doing it for a little bit, and it was awesome. Thank you.
Thank you.